Well, last week, Gavino got us started in a whole new section of text. We've been in the New Testament for a while, and we like to kind of go back and forth so we don't get, I don't want to say mired down. You can't get mired down in the Word, but we like to change things up a bit. Spend some time studying the New Testament, and then get some time in the Old Testament as well. So, we've moved from the New to practically the beginning. We're going to talk about Abraham for probably the next 3 or 4 months. He started us off at the beginning of chapter 12, and we're going to work all the way through probably the end of chapter 22. So, basically tracing out historically the life of Abraham and his walk of faith and the journeys that he was on. So, we're going to look at the rest of chapter 12 this morning, and obviously Gavino kind of trace things out in the first three verses with the promises that God started in the Abrahamic covenant. But I wanted to start with a personal story that kind of illustrates what I think the Lord wants us to flesh out in this text. Many of you know I'm an Aggie, and I went to Texas A&M, got some fellow Aggs in the room here. During my last year in college at A&M, I took a big step of faith. I'm not a risk taker. I'm kind of a cautious guy. I study, you can ask Jana, I study meticulously every purchase we make, and I waste a lot of time researching, looking for the best price. And so I don't easily take a big leap that's going to be scary for me. So for me, this was a big step of faith. For some of you, might be, okay. The big step of faith was coming to Italy as a missionary. And so I was about to graduate from A&M. It took me 5 years instead of 4. But I was really going headlong for the American dream. Like, I just wanted to get a good job, get a big house, big car. And not that those things are bad, but they had become an idol for me. That was all I was focused on. I hadn't really bothered to ask God what he wanted. And so God pulled me away from my dream, which had become an idol, and he pointed me towards his dream for my life, and that was ministry in Italy. Never considered ministry. It was not ever on my map. And in the span of 3 or 4 months in this last year, while I was at college, I surrendered to that plan rather reluctantly. It wasn't a pleasurable process. He was beating on my heart. And I was really, the issue was I was scared. I was scared of raising support, asking people for money. I was scared of trying to learn a new language and a culture. You can imagine some of the things, maybe the fears that you had in coming over. And as I said, I really never wanted to be a pastor, a missionary. That never was in my plans. I wanted to be an engineer, and that's what I studied to do. So in a sense, surrender to him and his plan meant the death of my plan. And I didn't like that. That was really hard to get over. The first months after I said yes to the Lord were really great. I mean, it was kind of a high, a spiritual high. Really rich times of prayer, rich fellowship with other believers. Preparing to go. There was a whole lot of faith in his ability to provide. I was riding kind of a high. I said, yes, Lord, I'll go. And so he provided this strength, I guess you could call it. But in the stress of graduating, the stress of raising support that kind of came in, stress of moving to a new country, during these stressful times, I had a big fall spiritually. I was riding this high wave spiritually, like I'm excited. And then I had a big sinful fall. I fell into pornography. So I'm riding this high. Everything's going really well with the Lord. And then spiritually, I find myself in this pit. And not many people around me even knew that it was happening. Had never struggled with this type of sin before, but now I was in this pit in the middle of it. I didn't really know what to do. It's really hard to get out of that particular sin. And I said to myself, this is shameful. I'm a new missionary. I'm preparing to go to the missions field to serve God. And here I am wallowing in this pit of pornography. What's with this? I didn't really know what to do. And this battle went on while I was preparing to go to Italy. And then during some of the first months, first year that I was here. This is about probably 15 years ago when I'm in my early 20s. Single guy, just trying to figure out what this new ministry is going to be. And I'm struggling with pornography. And I asked myself, are they going to send me home if I'm discovered? What's going to happen if this comes out? And the question was in my mind, is God big enough to still bring to fruition his plan for me despite my failure? Could he still use me despite the fact that I had this big failure in my life, spiritually speaking? So we can take great steps of faith and then soon quickly have big failures. That big step of faith doesn't mean things are going to just go peachy keen. Maybe you can think of an example in your life when you had a big fall soon after a big spiritual step. Maybe it was after getting baptized or right after you got saved. There was a big fall. Satan likes to attack when we feel like we're strong, when we think we're strong. Perhaps you've been a believer for many years and you've seen failure in the course of your life and your years of walking with Him. So we ask ourselves the question, is God able to maintain His promises despite our failings? Is He capable of bringing to fruition His plan in us despite our big falls? Is everything that He had planned for our lives ruined because we fell? God's Word speaks clearly to these questions. And we're going to see that in the life of Abraham in this text. So, in thinking of a title for this text, I gave it this title. Man's failures cannot stand in the way of God's promises. Man's failures cannot stand in the way of God's promises. Let's look at Genesis 12, from 4 to 20. It's a good long story. You know, these Old Testament narratives are good stories, so let's read through it all. So Abraham went forth as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. Now Abraham was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. Abram took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his nephew, and all their possessions which they had accumulated, and the persons which they had acquired in Haran, and they set out for the land of Canaan. Thus they came to the land of Canaan. Abram passed through the land as far as the site of Shechem, to the oak of Moreh. Now the Canaanite was then in the land. And the Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your descendants I will give this land." So he built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. Then he proceeded from there to the mountain on the east of Bethel and pitched his tent, with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. And there he built an altar to the Lord and called upon the name of the Lord. Abram journeyed on, continuing towards the Negev. Now there was a famine in the land. So Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. It came about, when he came near to Egypt, that he said to Sarai, his wife, "See now, I know that you're a beautiful woman, and when the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is his wife, and they'll kill me, and they will let you live. Please say that you're my sister, so that it may go well with me because of you, that I may live on account of you." It came about when Abram came to Egypt, the Egyptians saw that the woman was very beautiful, and Pharaoh's officials saw her and praised her to Pharaoh, and the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. Therefore he treated Abram well for her sake, and gave him sheep and oxen and donkeys, and male and female servants, and female donkeys and camels. But the Lord struck Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abraham's wife. Then Pharaoh called Abram and said, "What is this you've done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say, 'She's my sister,' so that I can take her in for my wife? Now then, here is your wife. Take her and go." Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they escorted him away with his wife and all that belonged to him. Genesis is great. It's full of scandals and all kinds of mess. We're going to see this in the next weeks as we go. It's kind of an exciting book. I mean, it's real life. It doesn't gloss over any of the mess of the patriarchs and the mistakes that they made. And that's what I love about the Word of God. It's true. It's honest. It's real. Okay? So we're going to see that God remained faithful to His promises despite Abraham's failures in this chapter. We'll also see how Abraham took a great step of faith in leaving his homeland, and then immediately taking two painful steps back. One step forward, two steps back. So, a quick review of what Gavino showed us last week in these first three verses. Obviously, he was looking at God's call to Abraham. Let me see if I can pull it up here. Let's read the intro to this chapter, which is huge, hugely important. "Now, the Lord said to Abraham, 'Go forth from your country, and from your relatives, and from your father's house, to the land which I will show you. And I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, so you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth will be blessed." So Gavino fleshed out some characteristics of God, aspects of God's character in these verses. He talked about God's sovereignty, the fact that God chose Abram and not vice versa. Think about that. We think of like, well, I chose to follow God. Well, actually, it was God that chose you and had pursued you for, and that was the case with Abraham. We talked about how God rules and reigns. He's the one that has the absolute authority, not us. And then drawing it towards the New Testament in Christ, it was Jesus that loved us and chose us first. We weren't the ones that chose him. In our minds, we think of that way. But he was the one that pursued us and loved us first. And we responded to him. Gavino teased out also God's grace. How much of God's grace we see in these promises. The fact that Abram was nobody. He was an idolater, a pagan in a pagan land. Wasn't searching after God. And God, for his own reasons, blessed Abram. Chose him to be the father of this nation. And we think also in terms of Christ in the New Testament, Jesus blessed us, dying on the cross, rising again, blessed us with the gospel message. That by faith, we can be sons of Abraham, if you will. Grafted in as sons and daughters of the Lord by faith in Christ. And then Gavino talked about God's faithfulness. The promises that he made here and the fact that God remains faithful to his promises. They don't ever get swept aside, forgotten. All his promises are kept, despite the failures of Abraham. And we're going to see that throughout his life. He didn't just fail in this chapter. There are other times. But God remained faithful. So we know that this passage right here is the beginning of the Abrahamic covenant. And it's going to kind of be fleshed out, this pact, this covenant that he made with Abraham throughout all the texts we're going to see up through chapter 22. So we'll see some in 15 and some in 22 as well, specifically about the covenant. So God appeared and made these promises to Abraham while he was in Ur of the Chaldees. Let's look at this map here. So Ur, right down here, in about present-day Iraq. You know, Kuwait's right down here. This is kind of present-day Iraq right here. You got the Tigris and Euphrates River. So Iraq and Kuwait and Iran, right in the center of a lot of biblical history. So Ur was Abraham's home. He served pagan gods in a pagan land. I think I read somewhere that they served moon gods. They were thoroughly, through and through, pagans. Abram was probably a rich man. He had many herds, many animals, which would signal that he has some respect in the culture. He's well known, probably a very wealthy man. History tells us that his culture around Ur was one of the most advanced at the time, if not the most advanced. So he's leaving the best that technology has to offer, if you will, in that time, best development as far as culture goes. And the idea of him leaving means he's going to leave his inheritance. You think about it, in that culture, your inheritance was land. It was animals. He can take the animals with him, but he's leaving all of his family's land. That's a big deal. He's going to leave his culture, his language, his family, things that all of you, in a sense, have done in coming here. Even if you plan to go back to your homeland, all of you have taken a step. You have a sense of what that means. And another thing, thinking on a cultural level, at this time in history, to leave one's homeland was really something only the losers of society did. And what I mean by that is the poor, the fugitives, those are the only people that left their home and went somewhere to another country. Really. Why would you leave all of your wealth, all of your family, ever? We're used to moving around. It's normal for us to maybe live in another country or move to another state for work. We live a long way from our family. We can call them up. We can Skype them. We can easily travel. In this time, it was very rare, very strange, very abnormal for a wealthy family especially to leave their homeland, their culture, and go somewhere else. So this is a huge step, a foolish step, thinking in worldly terms, for Abram. It's suicide in terms of his wealth, his name, his culture. So another thing to think about is the fact that it wasn't really even clear where God was taking him. God's telling him to go, but Abram doesn't really know where he's going. I mean, so he's not only leaving a lot of important things, but he doesn't even know really where. I don't know about you, but I like to know what the plans are a long time in advance. I like to research it, figure it out. For God to say, just go. I'll flesh it out for you down the road. What do you mean? I'm safe. I'm comfortable here, God. This is what Abraham is wrestling with. The Bible doesn't necessarily flesh all of his personal struggle out, but these are all the things that are probably going through his mind. Note also that God doesn't force Abraham with these promises, but he draws him, he invites him, he woos him through these promises that he's making. So chapter 11, just before our chapter in 12 here, chapter 11 finishes with Abram's family moving from Ur to Haran, way up north there. So that's probably near the border of Syria and Iraq, a hotbed right now for ISIS, okay, where Haran is. That's where he's traveled. And they traveled north. They took a northerly route following the rivers. These are two proposed routes because this is a very, very stark desert. To cross with all of his animals and his family from Ur to the promised land would have been suicide. They wouldn't have had the water or the food to survive. So they had to follow a northern route following the rivers. So Abram was obedient to this first requirement for blessing that we saw in these first verses. God said, leave your country. Okay? So Ur is the center of the pagan world. It's in spiritual darkness. God wanted a new start and a new place for his new people. Abram, in a sense, was also obedient to the second requirement, leave your relatives. Okay? So he's leaving his family home place. Obviously, he brings along some of his family with him this first trip. This was important because Abram's whole family was pagan, just like their culture. His immediate family comes along to Haran, and Lot travels on to Canaan with him to the promised land. But Lot chose to come along. He probably was a believer in Yahweh as well. And we find out further along in the New Testament that Lot was a righteous man who had faith in God. So Lot and Abraham eventually go separate ways. You remember Lot goes off and once he takes the beautiful land by Sodom and Gomorrah. and Abram goes in a different direction. That happens further along, we'll see. But in Genesis 11:32, the last verse of chapter 11, it speaks of the death of Terah, which is Abram's father. So basically, as Genesis 12:1-3, these promises happen, it's simply a flashback to when Abram was in Ur. Okay? So those promises that Gavino taught us about, that was back when he was in Ur. Okay? And now he's in Haran, about to take off again for the promised land. Okay, so 12:4, where we are, begins in Haran, right after Terah's death. And now, with his father dying, Abram is free to, in a sense, depart from his father's family, and now he's the patriarch of the family. So he's free to go. Before that, he kind of had to stay home and stay with his father's household. So now we're going to see, basically, I've written Abraham probably 50 times in here. It's Abram, same man. Abram's faith, we're going to see, kind of traced out as he takes this step of faith to the promised land. It starts out by saying, Abraham went forth. Let me go back up. There it is. So Abram went forth as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. This is a huge step of faith just in departing from Haran. Now, he's the patriarch of the family after Terah's death. So they're going to travel about 400 miles from Haran down to Shechem, which is about the middle of the of what is present-day Israel, the Promised Land. Okay? So about 400 miles or so, 600 kilometers down to the center of Canaan. So Abram stopped right in the middle there in Shechem. So this is Canaanite land, and the text says the Canaanite was in the land, basically saying this was a Canaanite culture. It was depraved. It was pagan, just like Ur, where he came from. So this is why Abram couldn't just immediately take possession of the promised land. This is the land promised to God's people, but he couldn't take possession of it because it's full of pagans, just like Ur was. Okay. So we also know that Canaan is a rich and fertile land. Even today, if you look at Esselunga right now, the avocados you buy, they're from Israel. The pink grapefruits, they're from Israel. A lot of the things that are out of season in Italy, they grow year round in Israel. So it's a fertile land. God was wise in his choice of this land for his people. And it said, the Lord appeared. Let's see here. The Lord appeared in verse 7. And this is the first time God is seen. Way before, he had shown himself in Ur and made these promises. But Abram's kind of going on faith all this time, making all this journey. And finally, God appears to him again. So this has got to be a, oh, okay. I don't know about you, but I would have been worried. I would have been saying, where's God? And finally, he can see this isn't a dream. God is true to his promises. And he's appeared to me again. And God reiterates the promises that he made here. He talks about, he says, to your descendants I will give this land. So he's reiterating promises he'd already made in Ur. So Abraham's descendants are promised this beautiful pagan land. And then he's promised descendants, but his wife is completely sterile. So it's like there are these obstacles to these promises being fulfilled. So obviously only God could bring to fruition, ultimately, these promises. Because they're huge obstacles. So what was his response to God? He built an altar to the Lord. Abraham bows before God in worship and praise. That's probably the right response to God's grace, huh? God's provision. It's his response to God's faithfulness in maintaining his promises. So in a sense, in building this altar to the Lord, he was making some very clear statements. He was saying publicly, this is my faith. This is my religion, if you will. He's establishing worship of the one true God, worship of Yahweh. And he's demonstrating his faith in God and in God's promises by building this altar. It was kind of a lot of symbolism into that act. In a sense, it's the beginning of a little kingdom of persons that worship Yahweh. For the first time, a small group of people, a little kingdom that's worshiping the one true God. For the first time, it's a kingdom that recognizes Yahweh is the only God. Because the pagan cultures have all these gods. But finally, there's a group of people that are saying, we worship the one true God, Yahweh. They obey, they worship and follow only Yahweh. The text goes on and said he proceeded to this mountain east of Bethel. That's actually, in Italian, it's Bethel, and it's Bethel in English. He's heading a little bit further south. Let me see if I've got another map in here. So he slides down a little further, following kind of along parallel to the Jordan River from Shechem down to Bethel. All right. And here he again builds an altar to the Lord for worship. And he keeps moving southward because the land in the south is better for grazing. All right. Central Canaan is very fertile. It's best suited for agriculture. And if you go there today, there are beautiful green fields everywhere, year-round, that they're growing things. But he, I'm sure, noticed that that's best suited for growing things. Southern Canaan is drier and best suited for pasture land and grazing. As you go further and further south below the Dead Sea, it turns into desert. So it's good grazing land as you go south. So stepping back a little bit from our looking at the text, thinking of things in a cultural sense, let's make this a little bit more personal. Do you remember a time or times in your life when you took a big step of faith with God? Your faith maybe was rock solid in that moment. You weren't fearful of that step because you were trusting him. You could see that goal clearly ahead. Maybe it was a new ministry, a new job, a new relationship. And that big step of faith matured your walk with Christ. It honored him. It glorified him. But then catastrophe struck. Maybe it was a horrible sickness. Maybe it was a death in the family. Maybe you lost your job in that moment. Maybe a broken relationship, a broken marriage. And suddenly your strong faith wasn't as strong anymore like it was before. That road that seemed so clear suddenly was dark and foggy. In an instant, you're disoriented. You're anxious. You're asking, where's God? Before, everything's great. Faith is strong. Catastrophe strikes like a punch in the stomach. And we're asking, where's God? Let's look at Abram's first failure in Genesis 10. Now, there was a famine in the land, and so Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. Let's flesh this out. Here's Abram's catastrophe, a severe famine in the land. We don't think much about that because if there's a famine in one part of the world, well, we'll get food from the other part. You know, if there's a drought in California, we'll get food from Mexico. We've got options. But in this type of culture, if there was a famine where you were, you typically just had to go somewhere else if you wanted to survive. So a famine put Abram's family and his livelihood at risk. So not only was his family at risk of dying, but also his whole livelihood, all of his wealth and his animals would croak if they couldn't find food. Okay? So in this passage, scholars disagree a little bit about whether Abram's going to Egypt was good or bad, was of faith or not of faith. Some say that he did right by taking this practical step to save himself and his family. Others say it was a plan in the flesh that didn't involve God. But it seems that Abram was running ahead of the Lord a little bit here in taking off for Egypt from the Promised Land. The text doesn't say anything about direction from God about Egypt. It's silent about that. But the same God that brought him safely here suddenly isn't able to help him in the middle of this catastrophe. This God in some way now isn't able to provide for Abram. Obviously, God could have provided through Egypt, and he ultimately did. But the text is silent about that. We don't know if the Lord led him here or not. It doesn't seem that this trip to Egypt was one that Abraham made in faith. It wasn't a step that seemed to be led by faith. It seemed more led by fear. Especially when we see Abraham's his behavior further on. So, thinking back on a personal level, do you remember how you reacted after that catastrophe hit? You're riding high on faith. You've taken this big step. The catastrophe hits. How did you respond? We would hope that we all faced it with rock-solid faith and unwavering trust in the Lord, but that's rarely how we face catastrophes, right? A lot of times we struggle through them with weak faith. Maybe because of fear you fell into sin like I did when my catastrophe hit. Or you ditched God's plan altogether, went off in your own direction. Perhaps you got angry at God or were depressed or hardened your heart towards him in the midst of all this. Or you reacted in the flesh, much like Abram did in going to Egypt. He was scared for his family and his livelihood, and for good reason. But his response wasn't one of faith, wasn't one of trust in God. So we see a little bit of his first failure. Now we're going to look at a second failure in lying to the Egyptians. I don't know about you, but I don't think I'd want to lie to the Egyptians. They're a crafty bunch. That's what Abram did. Let's see what happens. In a sense, we can see from our own lives that one failure often leads to others. It's often like a domino effect, right? We get into one jam and we start acting not in faith, and it often leads us to others. And that seems to be what happened with Abram. So Abram, out of fear, makes his own plan to protect himself. So he's fearful of getting murdered by Egyptians who wanted his wife. Apparently, Sarai was 65 years old at the time, but men lived a lot longer, and she was apparently still very beautiful at 65. And he was worried about her getting stolen and him getting slaughtered. Apparently, there was some precedent. This had happened before in history, and so he's worried about this. And so he tells Sarai to tell a half-truth. That she's his sister. If we're honest, a half-truth is still a lie. But truly, Abram's is Sarai's stepbrother. They have the same dad, but a different mom. He talks about this further on in Genesis 20. He says, "Besides, she actually is my sister, the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother. And she became my wife." There are families in East Texas that still do this type of thing. But cultures and genes were different in this time. And so We could get into a whole discussion about that. So Abram used a lie to fool the Egyptians. And for a time it worked. His idea in his mind and his human logic was, okay, all right, if someone comes along, I'm now her brother. They think I'm her brother. If someone wants to marry her, I'm the closest relative. They're going to come to me and make the arrangements, pay the dowry, whatever needs to be done. And we'll have time to jet out of there before this happens. He's thinking, I've got this under control. I can plan. I can make this work. But if you remember, it didn't quite work that way. He didn't calculate the fact that Pharaoh didn't need permission of anyone to take any woman. Pharaoh could just take any woman he wanted. And that's what happened. But maybe worse, we would hope to think, okay, he was trying to protect himself and his wife the whole bit. Maybe he wasn't thinking about Sarai's safety at all. Maybe he was just thinking about saving himself. Put her out there. I'm going to take care of my... We don't really know. But maybe in lying to the Egyptians, in a sense, he wanted to help God. You know how sometimes we like to help God do things? Do you remember that Abram helped God by taking Hagar and having a child with his wife's handmaid to help God to provide descendants? And to this day, the Arabs and God's people are fighting because of Abram helping God? Okay, so I think he's trying to help God here. And typically that doesn't flesh out real well. The idea is, he's thinking, how could God fulfill his promises to give me a descendant if I die in Egypt? So I've got to take care of this and fix this so we can get back. I can have my descendant. He's not thinking, wait, this is the God of the universe who's got all this under control. And of course, maybe he just wanted to save himself and use whatever means necessary to do it. We don't really know. But it all hit the fan worse than Abraham could have imagined. She does get taken by Pharaoh. She gets noticed by Pharaoh's princes and gets taken into the harem. That's not a good thing, right? Let's see where we are. I think we're right there. Yeah. In spite of... There wasn't any, obviously in this situation, there wasn't any permission getting from her brother. Okay, so Pharaoh doesn't come and ask, okay, could I have your sister as my wife? He just takes her. She gets taken into the harem. So there wasn't any time for that. Thankfully, God protected Sarai from being violated as a member of the harem. God had to intervene directly with plagues to preserve Sarai as Abram's wife. And in spite of this disobedience and lack of faith that Abram demonstrates, he gets blessed. God demonstrated incredible grace in this situation. Abram is even made rich by the fact that Sarai is taken by Pharaoh. He gets all kinds of livestock, which is the common wealth of the day. You didn't necessarily have lots of gold, but you had animals. You had livestock. So somehow, Pharaoh connects the plagues with this lie that Abram told. And they have a confrontation. Abram is humiliated by Pharaoh because Pharaoh asks these really in-your-face questions, rightly so. And Pharaoh arguably demonstrates more character here than Abram had demonstrated, right? Because Pharaoh's saying, whoa, wait, if this is your wife, I can't have her. I can't. Why did you lie to me about this? Like, seems like Pharaoh's the one with the clear mind of integrity, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense either. So Abram's family is expelled from Egypt in a rather humiliating way. I'm sure there was a lot of gossip going on among Abram's servants and all as they're being expelled from this country by the Pharaoh. I mean, they're lucky they didn't just get slaughtered. It was God's grace that they didn't get slaughtered and God's protection. So it's incredible, though, to look here and see that we already see the fulfillment of God's promises that he gave back at the beginning of chapter 12. Some of them are being fulfilled right here. Pharaoh is hit with plagues due to having Sarai in his house. Obviously, he did it unknowingly. But God is protecting Abram's descendants this way. He preserved Abram and his descendants. He blessed Abram and his descendants in the midst of all this. God brings them back safely to the promised land from being in Egypt. They didn't deserve any of these blessings, but God blessed them just the same. So as we think about this text and process this, I didn't want to leave you hanging without finishing my story of my failure. By God's grace, it has a good ending. God provided his grace to me through a kind colleague in Milan. I was a single guy, and I was being discipled by one of our team members, our Crossworld team members. And this colleague treated me with grace and with love, and he said, David, you're not alone. And I don't want you to walk alone through this failure, through this sin. He explained to me, he said, many believers, especially men, struggle with pornography. This is not an unusual struggle. It's sad, but it's not an unusual struggle in the body of Christ. Unfortunately, many Christian men struggle with this. And he took the time to help me fight this sin and find victory over it in the power of the Spirit. It wasn't an easy process, but he was willing to take that time and invest that time in me and show me the grace that I needed to be restored. So I guess the moral of my story, of Abram's story, we can come back and see that man's failures cannot stop God's promises or his plans. God can use you, he can use me, despite our failures in the past, our failures in the present. We cannot ruin his promises or his plans. He's even capable of using our failures for his glory. I don't know if you've noticed that looking back at your life and the failures, he can use those and draw honor to himself, even in our failures. How? It's beyond me, but he does it. Now, this doesn't mean that there's not going to be consequences for our sin and our failures. There will be. We're probably going to have to pay some tangible price for those sins. And we shouldn't expect to receive blessings necessarily for our sin like Abram did. This was a rare case, an unusual case. Usually there's a lot of difficulty that comes, a lot of complication, an issue that comes when we fall, or we have sin. But our God is the God of the impossible. He can overcome our obstacles.